Become our friend on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Talk 1370, the right choice. And online at talk1370.com.
Previously,
I think we have Scott online. He's on the line. Scott, welcome to Beyond the Birds and Bees.
Hey, it's funny. I turned on the radio. I'm like, well, this is the perfect time for me to get the answer to this question.
Well, good.
This is Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
This is Beyond the Birds and Bees, Talk Radio 1370. I'm Dr. Thomas Vaughn with the Texas Fertility Center. We have this session every Saturday from 12 to 1. And the Texas Fertility Center, the website is txfertility.com. Don't hesitate to go to it to learn more. And don't hesitate to give us a call at 390-1370. Today, what we're going to do is talk about a really frustrating problem for our couples, and that is miscarriage, and even go into a little bit of recurrent miscarriage. And I have a guest with me today, Dr. Karen Swenson, who's an obstetrician and gynecologist with Women's Partners in Health. Her office is next to Seton, that is at 38th Street, the Seton Medical Center. Karen, welcome.
Thank you.
We're just glad to have you with us. And what we want to do today is talk about miscarriage and recurrent miscarriage. And this sort of overlaps what we both practice, I would say, almost daily. Wouldn't you say it's very common?
Yes, it is very common. Miscarriage occurs in about somewhere between 10 and 15% of pregnancies.
Yeah, and you know what? And that overall is what we see. And in our practice, we tend to see women who are older. And the miscarriage rate in that group is even higher. In fact, when women get in the mid-40s, over half of their pregnancies can miscarry. So 10 to 15% for the entire reproductive age is a lot of pregnancies that are lost.
Yes, it is.
And don't you think it's just really devastating to patients and couples? And
People get very sad when they've had a miscarriage.
It is a loss. You know, it really is. And I remember going through training and a woman would have a miscarriage and it would be a DNC, and it's a relatively simple procedure to do. And a lot of times it seemed to be so routine. And unless you've really experienced it, you really don't know how devastating it is and what a loss it is.
And for a lot of women, when they have a miscarriage, it's kind of a silent suffering. And they will go through a whole list of things. I always say that they kind of replay the tapes of the early part of their pregnancy and look for things that maybe that they did wrong or experienced, and that just adds to their sadness. So I always try to tell people when they do have a loss that they have to go back and tell themselves, Dr. Swenson told me that I didn't do something to cause this.
Oh, boy, how important is that? I mean, so many of these are due to just things that happen. In fact, we will get into the causes and everything, but it's not inappropriate to tell you that at least 70 to 80% of pregnancy losses are genetic, and therefore it just was not a good sperm or a good egg without any control over the couple has over that. So people feel so guilty. How many times have you heard, maybe I shouldn't have exercised?
All the time.
All the time.
Exercise, or I shouldn't have had that drink that I had before I even knew I was pregnant, or I shouldn't have traveled.
Had intercourse, all these sorts of things.
Yes.
It's just amazing. It is interesting how patients will look, they're looking for reasons, and they want to blame themselves. I mean, it's tough. And so we see it affect a large number of our patients, I think, in both of our practice. Wouldn't you think your partners do too? By the way, can you tell us who's in your practice, your partners?
My partners include Dr. Diana Weiss, who I've been in practice with now for 25 years, Stephanie Reach, Vanessa Yim, Danelle Oliver, Felicia Nash, and Natasha Iqbal.
I just think it's great. It's a great group, and there are three groups that are kind of the anchor groups of Seton Medical Center downtown, and clearly you're one of the groups and take care of a large number of patients in the community. But back to miscarriages, I feel that we've said this so many times, but no one can really feel the pain unless they've walked in their shoes. And it's, but I think even as a male gynecologist that we just see how much it really affects the couple, the women, and the women and men deal with this a little differently.
The women feel it, I think, more deeply and into their core, and because they've been experiencing the effects of the early pregnancy, the physiologic effects, the nausea, the vomiting, the breast tenderness, and the men are just kind of in the process of getting used to the fact that their wives are pregnant. So when the woman has the loss, it's just such a deep loss, and the men are just trying to figure out how to support their partners.
Very difficult. You know, it for the guys, it's kind of like it's not quite real because they never see anything, they never feel anything. It sometimes it doesn't even feel as real when the woman is in her second and third trimester because they're really not, they're part of it, but it's not affecting their body.
Correct.
It's pretty amazing. And you know, we've talked about this a little bit before on the show, but there is some grieving that goes on after this, and the stress is very important, and couples process differently. Women, if they can, would like to talk about it, and sometimes the guys don't want to talk about it. And part of the problems with guys is that they're fix-it people, so if they can't fix it, then they just don't want to talk about it.
And I think the guys sometimes are ready to move on a little quicker than the women are. The women
that's
are
for
just
sure. Because it then
still processing,
and for them they may be able to get through that a little quicker. Again, having not been the person that experienced the medical part of the pregnancy loss.
But then it's interesting too because they're both very scared when they get pregnant the next time.
I think so. We have seen, particularly with women with recurrent miscarriages, we've seen couples that are afraid to become pregnant and sometimes will avoid getting pregnant, have excuses subconsciously, and therefore they didn't get pregnant, so they didn't fail. They look at being such a failure.
A lot of times women that are having have had one miscarriage, though, we all look ahead to the next one expecting that one's going to be normal. So they enter into that pregnancy really excited, and they think this time it's going to work. And then when they have another loss, that's even more devastating.
For sure. And, you know, the chance of miscarrying the second time is not over 20%. It's still like 15 to 20% at the most. So odds are in your favor to just try again. And yet it is that fear. And I don't know how many times I've had patients tell me when they do conceive again, they've got to get past that point where the miscarriage was diagnosed.
Mm-hmm. I always liken it to holding your breath. People
right.
are holding their breath until they've reached that that benchmark, and then they have a sigh of relief.
For sure. And, you know, it's interesting because miscarriages can, of course, occur anytime in the first trimester, but there's even data showing that in an individual couple who do tend to lose their pregnancies, they do tend to occur very close to the same time. I don't mean within days, but within weeks. So you can see that just reinforces it more.
Mm-hmm.
And holding your breath is just a really good description of what they're doing. I know that when patients come in and they're beyond that point and we're going to do a sonogram to see if the heartbeat's still there, that they're not sure they want to do it. They want to do it, but they're afraid to do it. And I'm always asking, do you really want to do this? And they're going, I don't know if I want to do it or not, but of course they do. But you can just see how much, how stressful it is.
It's kind of like they have to take little baby steps.
For sure.
At each little step.
Yeah. And I think when women are being monitored in their pregnancy for progesterone levels and HCG growth, that is helpful. Although it doesn't guarantee that the pregnancy will be good, it does reinforce that things have gone well so far. Yeah. So what we would like to do, too, is to kind of get into looking at reasons for miscarriages, because if a couple has one miscarriage, I think all of us would say, if your examination is normal and everything looks straightforward, let's just try again. But if a woman's had several miscarriages, then I think that it's not only appropriate to do this, I think we need to, at least when a woman has had three miscarriages, do an evaluation to see if we can find something correctable. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I totally agree. And there are even some people that would suggest that we do that after two.
I hear you. Boy, do we hear that a lot. Of course, that's kind of what we're spending all of our days doing. And I think when patients come in after even one, if they want to be evaluated, it seems appropriate to do some of the basic tests because they're relatively inexpensive. They're not risky to the patient like a surgical procedure. And so we're very happy to start looking at some of the basic things. But at two, I think then all of a sudden we're really more interested in pushing them to do something.
Yeah, because the incidence of a miscarriage after two is higher. It's somewhere between 20 and 30%.
Well, one of the things that we try to talk about before we actually get to the testing is to talk about what patients can do to ensure that they're doing the best things to encourage a good pregnancy and decrease the chance of a miscarriage. For instance, smoking.
We want people to absolutely stop smoking. Smoking is a toxin to our eggs and will prematurely age us. And please, that's one thing for sure. And as your pregnancy progresses, if you are a smoker, it has impacts on your pregnancy as well.
There's not anything good that we can say about smoking. We know that in infertility, it decreases the chances of getting pregnant in a given month as much as 30%. That's pretty profound. And Karen, what you said about aging and killing eggs, it is so true. We see women who have smoked that they have premature menopause, premature ovarian failure, premature loss of eggs, in addition to having trouble carrying a pregnancy whenever when you do become pregnant. So it's one thing that a couple can do to increase their chances of conceiving.
I love it when patients come to the office and are in preparation of achieving a pregnancy. They want to know all the things to do, be on their vitamins, make sure they're taking folic acid. And I always tell people to do all the good health habits that they imagine themselves doing when they are pregnant before they're pregnant. Make sure they're up to date on all their vaccinations and in anticipation of getting pregnant.
So important, so important. And also folic acid, one of the more important things, not because it lowers the chance of miscarriage, not because it increases the chance of conceiving, but because it decreases the chance of a birth defect.
Correct.
So what do you tell them about that? What is the one thing that it will lower the chance of occurring?
The one thing that folic acid supplementation lowers the chance of occurring is a defect in the neural tube, which is affected in the very early part of the pregnancy. So that's very important for people to be on folic acid.
And this defect in the neural tube is kind of a situation where the spinal column during development
doesn't come
close,
together.
And it leads to difficulty controlling the bladder and bowel movements, and it's forever.
It is, and it can be even more devastating than that.
So it's a real important thing to do. I tell our patients, you can take these little folic acid pills or eat Brussels sprouts three times a day, and they're going, where are the pills? Even if you like Brussels sprouts, three times a day is a bit much. Also, there is some data on weight. You know, being, and not necessarily exactly what the insurance charts say, but not being significantly overweight or significantly underweight. And that's another part of what you're talking about with your preconception counseling. And we all know that both of those have an effect, even in women who get pregnant and don't miscarry, can have an effect on the baby during the pregnancy. So I'm sure that's part of your routine also.
We always want our patients at their best weight. They can be.
Very, very important.
Women walk in with a lot of guilt around their weight, and I also try to counsel them to do the best they can.
Mm-hmm.
And then depending on where we start at that in this particular pregnancy will guide us in their how much weight to gain, what kind of exercise to do, and how we monitor the pregnancy for the duration.
Yeah, I think that's real important. We see that with the patients trying to become pregnant. They're having trouble conceiving, not necessarily conceived in miscarriage, but trouble conceiving. And it is really hard to say, why don't you come back when you've lost 50 pounds or something like that? That seems so insensitive, even though ideally that would be good. But it turns out that we feel the best way to do this is we will help you get pregnant if you will help yourself get pregnant. So I think it's the same idea that we're going to work together rather than sending someone home and just come back when you are at your quote-unquote ideal body weight, unless it is really, really off the bell-shaped curve where it's going to be very dangerous.
Correct, yeah.
What about caffeine? Caffeine, the data on caffeine is really, really mixed. Now, caffeine has been shown to lower the chance of getting pregnant after a certain number of milligrams, like after 300 milligrams, which would be 3 cups of coffee a day, it can lower the chance of getting pregnant by 20%, and even 100 milligrams lower the chance of getting pregnant by 10%. Now, let me translate that. The chance of a fertile couple conceiving each month may be 20%. So that caffeine, if it lowers it 10%, lowers it from 20 to 18%, not 20 down to 10. But I don't think the data has been clear at all in regard to caffeine and miscarriages. We have encouraged women to drink caffeine in moderation, not necessarily eliminate it. But, you know, we see patients all the time that will drink a 6-pack of Diet Coke a day.
I like to have my patients just stick with maybe 1 glass of caffeine a day. Sometimes in the early part of their pregnancy, they're so fatigued that a second glass in the afternoon sometimes helps them.
That's really good. So with those things in mind, being sure we're taking folic acid, be sure we're doing the behavioral things, and then if a patient has hypertension or diabetes, to be sure that's under control is very helpful. And a lot of times these patients have primary cares that are working on it, but maybe they just haven't followed up as much. And wouldn't you say it's reasonable for them to reconsult their physician that's treating them for hypertension or diabetes? And
absolutely, especially because when you're pregnant, we have expectations of you being in much better control in both your diabetes and your hypertension. If your hemoglobin A1C, which is a measure of your diabetic control, is really high, it can increase your risk of birth defects. And for women that have hypertension, if they're the hypertension can affect the blood flow to the uterus and cause the baby to not grow as well. So we think those are really important things to have under control, and we continue to monitor them throughout the pregnancy.
You know, the whole thing is about the baby. It sounds like I'm Dr. Laura. You know, Dr. Laura, everything is about the baby, no matter what's going on otherwise. But, you know, it's not a bad perspective with couples trying to get pregnant and have a baby that we want to make it the safest it can be for this baby. All of these things are helpful, and then also will lower the chance of losing the pregnancy once a woman does conceive. So if a couple's having trouble getting pregnant and they come in, the first thing, of course, we need to do is an examination.
I do a full exam.
Great.
Repeat their pap smear, make sure that we know the uterus is normal sized and there aren't any swellings in the ovary, cysts that have formed, and then check their thyroid, do a full exam. It's really important.
And as you mentioned, thyroid, that's something else to consider, that even if a woman's thinking about becoming pregnant and she's had thyroid disease, to be sure that that's under control as well. But all of these things are kind of the foundation of working then toward trying to find a cause for why a couple has lost a pregnancy, making sure their general health is okay, up to date on pap smears, breast exams, and all those things. And then it's appropriate to start looking at what we know can increase the chances of losing a pregnancy. And one the most common cause is actually genetic. And we mentioned that a little earlier. Something was not right about that sperm or that egg without the control of the couple, and therefore the embryo was not very good. And I think it's important for our listening office to understand, audience to understand that it's not that the uterus rejects the pregnancy. It's that it wasn't competent enough to grow and give us a baby.
And those genetic defects are usually very random. In a pregnancy loss, they're usually not things that are repeatable. I always tell people that the environment, based on in any given moment, it's almost a random event that these that the egg and the sperm that got together at that time did not have the correct genetic material. It's not usually something that's going to be repeated.
I think that's very true. It's in fact, it's rare that it's something that would be repetitive. So if we say it's genetic, then the first thing you would think of is, well, we need to check the chromosomes of the man and the woman, which is a blood test. Expensive blood tests can be $500 or $600. But if we do that, even in a couple who's had three pregnancy losses, the chance of finding an abnormality is like 5 to 6%. It's very, very low, which I think goes back to just what you said, Karen. That is that this is sort of a random event and is not necessarily repetitive, that even with all these pregnancy losses, and they're probably genetic, we have genetically normal individuals as a couple.
And the couples in which that 5 to 6% in which they do have something that's repetitive, it's a relief to have that information. And then they have a better sense of anticipation as they proceed with their next attempts at pregnancy.
I think that's very important. I mean, we sit and look at things as a scientist, so to speak, but it is so important to realize this couple, they're human beings, and information that we can get to them, helps them deal with the process they're going through. Very, very stressful situation. So here we have we're saying most likely genetic, but not recommending necessarily the couple have chromosomal studies. Couple reasons. One is that it's expensive. It's usually not covered by insurance unless you've had several, and statistically it's unlikely to show us something. But once you get to that magic number of three, that's when we start saying, now we think this is worthwhile. And it's not like we're sending couples out and say, oh, you have to lose three times before we'll help you. That's not the idea at all.
No, and then I think sometimes it's really helpful to look at women's hormonal milieu as well in the evaluation, making sure that they're ovulating regularly and have adequate progesterone production, as well as looking at their I always hear you say the age of their eggs, the mm-hmm. FSH and the estradiol. Do you do that in your evaluations, Thomas?
You know, we do. And particularly when the woman is in her mid-30s and or she has really short cycles. Because that FSH level going up on day three reflects a decrease in the number of eggs in the ovary. But also what that elevated FSH does is stimulate that cycle to ovulate earlier. So if we turn that around backwards, a short cycle may mean, not necessarily, but may mean that that's becoming an issue with that. But ovulation is one of the very important aspects of the evaluation. The progesterone supplementation, or progesterone can be supplemented if the progesterone level is low or if the luteal phase. Luteal phase is from ovulation to the next period if it's short. And by the way, by definition, a menstrual period, day one, is the first day of flow, not spot, not red, not brown, just flow, enough to change a tampon because you need to change a tampon. And if you go from ovulation until that day, you want it to be at least 12 days. That's something couples can look at themselves before they come in, but that's very important. You know, one of the problems, Karen, is that sometimes we'll see a pregnancy, we both do this, where the HCG level may be okay, but the progesterone level is low. So we have bad analogy, metaphor, but is it the chicken or the egg, so to speak? In other words, is it a bad pregnancy leading to poor progesterone production or a low progesterone with a good pregnancy that you may lose the pregnancy? You run across that?
I do run across that not infrequently, and that leaves us with a little bit of a dilemma about what to do with the next pregnancy. So often I'll go ahead and maybe check a progesterone level on the next pregnancy or even do some empiric treatment with progesterone.
And with the empiric treatment, the feeling is that we're not going to hurt anybody with that. We don't give it to everyone, but we're not going to hurt anything or hurt a pregnancy. The chance of it hurting a pregnancy is quite low.
We use progesterone all the time in pregnancy now.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, it's not a black box, but there's a box on the progesterone that says that not to be used during pregnancy, and that's when most of us use it during pregnancy. And it was from some really bad, bad data in 1974 from a pediatrician in Colorado that said he had a few kids that didn't look good. He noticed that they were exposed to progesterones and therefore reported that to the FDA, and the FDA got irritated and said shouldn't be used. It turned out when you look back, some of the progesterones were not natural progesterone, like suppositories and prometrium. They were not abnormal, but synthetic progesterones, like in birth control pill. And also when the women were re-interviewed, they found out that they thought their vitamin was a progesterone. So the data was terrible, and we're still living with that. But clearly the progesterone supplementation, the benefits outweigh the risk. And I think what you're saying is that if we have a pregnancy where things look like it's going well, and we give progesterone, we may be saving a good pregnancy. And if it's a bad pregnancy, it's going to be a bad pregnancy. And sometimes couples are worried that you're going to save a bad pregnancy and I'm going to have a baby with a birth defect.
I always tell my patients that supplementing progesterone, if it was not meant to be, is not going to help.
And I would say the most it does is delay the patient losing the pregnancy.
Maybe by a few days or so.
By a few days, right. Not much at all. What else do you check?
I check the anatomy of the patient. I usually do that either with a sonohistogram or with something called a hysterosalpingogram. This is after the exam that we know that everything's been normal. Looking at the lining of the uterus and making sure that there are no septa or unusual shaped uteri.
Explain real quickly what a saline histogram is.
Saline histogram is doing an ultrasound on the patient or a sonogram where we put a little teeny catheter past the cervix into the uterus and inject a little bit of saline,
mm-hmm.
Salt water, and get a chance to look at how the cavity looks to make sure that it's a regular, smooth-walled cavity that doesn't have any defects or polyps or separations in it.
And
we usually do that. We do it in the office. Mm-hmm. It can be done by the radiologist, I think, as well.
Right. And this can give you an idea if there's something in there like a polyp or a fibroid, and also, as you mentioned, the shape. And a septum, is a division of the uterine cavity. And if you can think of a triangle stood on the table with a point down and the other two points up, the point down would be the cervix, the other two points up would be the tube. And that top wall should be straight across, and a septum gives you a dip in that top wall so that if you image the inside of that triangle now, it might look like a heart, or if it's really deep, it could look like rabbit ears. And that wall that's coming down that actually was there and didn't dissolve or resorb during embryological time in the individual's life does not have as good a blood supply, and therefore, if an embryo attaches to it, it's a little more likely to miscarry. So we do learn about the structure. Now, there's some of these things that are congenital. That means that the women are born that way. And interestingly, there was a study in Baylor looking at these that were found even incidentally, and up to 6% of women had abnormalities in the development of their uterus. And not all of these were women trying to get pregnant or miscarrying. Just, it's noted, it's not uncommon for the uterus not to be perfectly formed. And it doesn't have to be perfect to be a good baby carriage.
No, it doesn't. But it is amazing when a patient's had their septum resected through a procedure called
hysteroscopy.
Mm-hmm. How fulfilling that is for them to have their next pregnancy and be successful.
It really makes us look good, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Because actually these women with a really deep septum, mm-hmm. where the image may be like rabbit ears, their miscarriage rate could be as high as 70 to 80% without repair, which before it was 20, and you can reverse those numbers if you do a good repair. So it is real satisfying. It kind of reminds me of other things with hysteroscopy where there may be a fibroid and the women are having really abnormal bleeding, uncontrollable, and you go in and resect the fibroid just for gynecological reasons, not even maybe miscarriage reasons, and their periods become normal again. It's very satisfying.
I forgot to mention that when I'm drawing blood to check the hormones, I will also check another set of blood work called the lupus anticoagulant and an anticardiolipin antibodies as well. Those have a little bit higher incidence of repetitive miscarriage when women carry those.
Can you explain just a little bit more? These are two laboratory tests that look at like an antibody that can attack the pregnancy, right?
That's right. They identify the pregnancy as being abnormal, or they set up certain circumstances which does not allow for the pregnancy to continue to grow. And they're so easily, those are two things that are pretty easily treated in the first trimester with baby aspirin and a heparin. So that's another very satisfying thing to find for a couple is when they have that kind of abnormality.
This has kind of been a very interesting area because so many patients will have all sorts of other laboratory tests done that are kind of like phospholipid antibodies. And probably the expert, at least in our group, is a physician named Ware Branch. And he's at the University of Utah. And he is actually a maternal fetal medicine, not a reproductive endocrinology person like what we are for infertility. But he takes care of high-risk pregnancies. And he has looked at this extensively with studies and basically has concluded that these are really the only two tests worthwhile to evaluate. And all of the other things are probably insignificant, even though they may turn out to be positive. So anyone who's out there listening who has been looking at this, and particularly at some of the things that are coming out of the upper Midwest where you have to be on gamma globulin being given intravenously and natural killer cells and all these other things, please look for Ware, W-A-R-E, Branch. Google him and read what he has to say. In the professional circles, he's considered to be the person who has evaluated things most scientifically. And then there's one other area. It's considered an infection, and it's with bacteria called mycoplasma and ureaplasm. And it's controversial in that, is it significant or not? It is really easy to treat if you do a culture and find it to be positive. It is a tetracycline or erythromycin for the couple. We are undecided as to how important we think it is. So therefore, we do tend to culture for it, but we don't think it's that important of an issue. And but we still do this on occasion. So the primary things, I think, are really the others that we talked about. Have y'all been doing any mycoplasm, ureaplasm cultures?
We have in years past, and currently there's now a lab test that it's a little easier to perform and can be sent pretty easily and get results pretty quickly that we've been trying out in our office.
And so if you have something positive, you treat the man and the woman?
Yes, we do.
Yes. And it's kind of interesting because when we do a hysterosalpingogram, that's an x-ray of the uterus and tubes, which more commonly is used for tubal patency to make sure the tubes are open, but gives us an image of the uterus. We treat both the man and the woman with a tetracycline antibiotic to try to decrease the risk of an infection from the procedure, but maybe we're also treating some of these bacteria that have not been seen. So we're coming up against a break, and we'd like for you to hang in there with us as we go through the break and join us again, and we will finish talking about pregnancy losses. I'm Dr. Thomas Vaughn with Dr. Karen Swenson with Beyond the Birds and the Bees. I'm Dr. Thomas Vaughn with the Texas Fertility Center, and with me is Dr. Karen Swenson. We have been talking about recurrent pregnancy losses, and I'm so happy that Karen has joined us. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist with Women's Partners in Health, and also she is chief of staff at Seton Hospital, and that's a really cool thing. I mean, after all, there's like 1,800 people on the staff, and she is the chosen one to lead the group, and so you can tell how much respect that she has in the community. And we have been talking about these pregnancy losses. We appreciate everyone listening to us on this beautiful day with ACL going on, and we're glad that you took a break a little bit from the music. But what we were finishing up before the break was going through the things that we think that we can look at that possibly we could change to increase the chances of carrying a pregnancy. And, you know, one of the things, Karen, is kind of interesting that I tell patients without it sounding too cheesy, so to speak, is that it's better in our situation to have a couple who has conceived, even if they lost the pregnancy, than have not conceived, that their chance of having a baby is actually higher than a couple just like them that had never conceived, because they can prove that the sperm can penetrate the egg, and the egg can grow, the fertilized egg can grow, be nourished, and transported into the uterus. And it's important for these couples to find something positive in their loss. Don't you agree?
That's interesting. I totally agree with you.
You know, the old cliche, it's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. I mean, you know, and I don't say it that way to him, but it's the same kind of concept.
And it gives you a place to start in terms of looking at how to evaluate them and how to reassure them that more than likely they are going to ultimately have a successful pregnancy.
The odds are so much in their favor that they will. Now, that doesn't work as well after the second and third miscarriage, because they'd say, we've already proven that we can get pregnant. Now we got to get one to stick, mm-hmm. they will call it. Well, it's stuck. It did implant, but it didn't grow. And I think that we probably made it pretty clear that we think that most of these are genetic losses.
They are. They are genetic losses.
Yeah. There's a couple things that we received as questions, which I think seem pretty obvious to physicians, but are not always obvious to patients, like, is it okay to have a pap smear when you're pregnant, or is that going to increase my chance of miscarriage?
It's just fine to have a pap smear when you're pregnant. I do have patients, though, that make me promise not to do a pap smear until they've gone beyond the first trimester. So although there's no data to support not doing a pap smear, I'll go ahead and respect their wishes.
Well, particularly if they're low risk mm-hmm. to have a problem. I mean, why not? Why not, you know, if somebody you've taken care of for a while and she had a normal pap smear a year and a half ago?
You can wait.
You can wait. I mean, also what we hear is that doing a vaginal sonogram may increase the risk of miscarriage.
There's lots of data on the safety of ultrasound, and I'm very reassured with vaginal sonography. One of the things, though, that I think we do need to avoid is doing the blood flow sonograms in the first trimester.
The Doppler flow. And of course, we will do that briefly whenever we're looking for a heartbeat. But the big blood flow studies is what you're talking about.
That's right.
It makes sense. I think that it's always important in medicine to do things that that don't have risk involved, unless you just really need to. The old saying of do no harm, so to speak. And it is interesting that in some practices, patients will have ultrasounds done almost on every visit. And so that's how things vary across the community. One of the other things that we heard was, and this varies a lot too, is, if I had a miscarriage, when can I have intercourse, and when can I attempt again? Now, of course, let's assume this is uncomplicated. She did it on her own, or she had a very gentle DNC. What do you tell patients?
I usually tell people after a miscarriage to not have intercourse for at least a couple of weeks after the completion of the miscarriage or the DNC, and then ask them to use a method of contraception, usually a condom, for the first couple of weeks after that and wait for their next period. In most cases, I am letting my patients go ahead and attempt pregnancy after they've had a nice normal period after a loss, which you can expect to have a period somewhere between 2 and 4 weeks after the loss.
We're just identical. I mean, everything we do is just identical to what you're doing. So I appreciate the validation that that's not a bad thing to be telling people. I think if a patient had a pregnancy loss and she was working on some of the things that we had talked about trying to improve, and they hadn't done such a good job, like had not quit smoking or whatever it may be, didn't have the diabetes completely under control, I think that's an opportunity to not make them feel like it was their fault, but to try once more to get everything on your side to make it most likely to be a successful pregnancy.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea.
We talked a little bit in that first segment about how patients just feel so guilty, and it's a fine line, don't you think, between trying not to make them feel guilty but also trying to help them make it more likely to be successful?
To encourage them.
I think it really is.
The other thing, I think sometimes women aren't quite ready, even if you give them permission to go ahead and try to get pregnant. And I try to make it up to the patient for when they want to get started again, and not like push them into trying, but give them a chance. Sometimes waiting a couple months, 2 to 3 months, is what really feels right. Well, that's what you need to go with.
So true. I mean, and I think our perspective is, this is when it's okay medically. As a couple, you guys decide when it's okay for the two of you. And there's a big variation in what couples think about that.
There is. And then when they are successful in achieving the pregnancy, then that adds to a whole nother dimension of anxiety for people.
Well, there's just so much anxiety. Oh, my gosh. You know, and we also talked about the process of the grieving process and how couples deal with it. You heard me say in the last segment that guys, because they're fix-it people, they kind of just don't want to deal with it because they can't fix it. And also being a little bit detached because it's not their body, they're kind of like, okay, done, let's get on to the next step. And that's really difficult. And to try to get the guys to understand that it's different for the women.
And especially when they're trying to process what their loss and their grief, and then looking ahead and wanting to be positive about the next step.
For sure. For sure. You know, it's interesting how men and women process. Like, the women a lot of times want to talk about things, and the guys are the opposite. They don't want to talk about things because they don't know how to fix it. And then the guys are kind of asking, they're thinking the women are asking them to fix it, and they're really not wanting to fix it. They just want to talk about it. So it's almost a disconnect. So we have to really figure out the best place to be so that everyone can work through this. Very difficult area for sure. Anything else that you might give to a couple who, I'm sorry, advice to a couple who's had a pregnancy loss? Can you think of anything else? I know that you said a little bit about exercise, and I think we can over-exercise and under-exercise, but exercise is a great way to deal with stress.
It is. I tell people when they do get pregnant that they're going to have a lot of mixed feelings, because people that have recurrent pregnancy loss don't have problems, like you already pointed out, in getting pregnant. So they are going to get pregnant again. And when they do get pregnant, how they I let them be involved in how many visits we have early on, let them call the office as often as they need to, because we talked a little earlier about how they benchmark their loss and need a lot more attention. I think that's really important to help people and give them permission to call us and ask as many questions as they need.
So important in whatever we do in medicine. That is so important. Communication is important. The ability or the availability of at least someone on our staff to be able to answer a question, even if you're in the operating room or delivering a baby, that someone can take that question and touch base with you later.
And some people want to come and see you right away, and other people want to wait.
That's right. Let them guide you, because it's not going to hurt their health at all. And I think the most important thing is everyone, just about everybody, will win this battle. Just about everyone will be able to get pregnant and have a baby. They can try again, even if they have to go to what some people call the nth degree, where you take embryos and biopsy them and determine which ones are genetically normal and put those in. Just about everyone can win if they can just hang in there. Karen, I really appreciate you being with us this Saturday, and particularly on a beautiful Saturday where I'm sure you could be doing a lot of things outside, and it's been very helpful. Thank you so much. Next week, Drs. Kaylin Silverberg and Rinku Mehta have invited Dr. Joe Chowdhury, an obstetrician gynecologist in Round Rock, to be their guests on our Saturday show. They plan to discuss endocrine abnormalities in pregnancy, such as diabetes and thyroid disease. Please tune in to our Beyond the Birds and Bees next Saturday on Talk Radio 1370. I'm Dr. Thomas Vaughn and Dr. Karen Swinson with me. We hope you enjoyed the show. We want to thank you for listening. Have a great weekend. Enjoy ACL and all of the other great opportunities for living in Austin, Texas.
Since 1952, Greater Texas Federal Credit Union's been your secure and stable financial institution. Discover exciting investment opportunities by meeting with our financial planner, a free service offered to our members. Visit gtfcu.org for more details. Greater Texas Federal Credit Union, your financial partner for life.
Aggie football season is here, and Wings and More wants to say, howdy, Ags! Wings and More, proud sponsor of Aggie football, is hosting watch parties for all televised games this season. With their 55-inch flat-screen HD TVs, great wings, and cold beer, there's no better place to meet your fellow Ags to watch the game. Mark your calendars to come by Wings and More, located at I-35 and Howard Lane on Saturday, October 9th at 2:30 to watch your Fighting Texas Aggies beat Arkansas in the Southwest Classic.
Looking for quality agricultural products that will last a lifetime? You'll appreciate tough Kubota equipment at Lanford Equipment. From tractors to construction equipment, lawn and garden products to utility vehicles, Kubota builds high-performance machines that are rugged, reliable, and ready to work. They are some of the toughest, hardest-working, most dependable machines on the planet. Kubota, everything you value. Visit Lanford Equipment in Austin and Marble Falls, or go to lanfordequipment.com to learn more.
Hey, Aggies, who's the number one pest control company in Austin? You know it, ABC Home and Commercial Services. With the weather changing, rats, raccoons, and mice are seeking shelter inside your home. No matter what kind of rodents adopt you, ABC can get rid of them. They'll close up the openings where they come in and catch any already in the house. Plus, all ABC specialists undergo comprehensive background checks so you can feel comfortable with ABC's pest team on your property. Call them and tell Bobby Jenkins, Class of 81, Dave said.
KJCE Rollingwood Austin.
KKMJ FM HD3 Austin.
Join our Talk Listener Club at talk1370.com.